I never produced the books I dreamed of, those well-reviewed, almost bestsellers, but I do make a pretty good living as a writer, and I count my blessings. Thousands are not so lucky. I've moved steadily up the income ladder to where I am now working at Commercial Flight, a periodical you've probably never heard of. A year after I took over as editor-in-chief, I found myself back on the UNH campus. I was there to attend a two-day symposium on the future of trade magazines in the 21st century. During a break on the second day, I strolled over to Hamilton Smith Hall on a whim and peeked under the basement stairs. The themes, celebrity-studded seating charts, and Albanian artwork were gone. So were the chairs, the sofa, and the standing ashtrays. And yet someone remembered. Scotch-taped to the underside of the stairs, where there had once been a sign proclaiming that the smoking lamp was always lit, I saw a sheet of paper with a single typed line in print so small I had to lean in close and stand on tiptoe in order to read it. Professor Nako now teaches at the Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry. Well, why not? Why the fuck not? As for Wendy, your guess is as good as mine. I suppose I could use Google that 21st century magic eight ball to chase her down and find out if she ever realized her dream, the one of owning the exclusive little boutique. But to what purpose? Gone is gone. Over is over. And after my stint in Joyland, just down the beach from a town called Heaven's Bay, let's not forget that, my broken heart seemed a lot less important. Mike and Annie Ross had a lot to do with that. My dad and I ended up eating his famous chicken casserole with no third party in attendance, which was probably all right with Timothy Jones, although he tried to hide it out of respect for me. I knew his feelings about Wendy were about the same as mine about Wendy's friend Renee. At the time, I thought it was because he was a bit jealous of Wendy's place in my life. Now, I think he saw her more clearly than I could. I can't say for sure, we never talked about it. I'm not sure men know how to talk about women in any meaningful way. After the meal was eaten and the dishes washed, we sat on the couch drinking beer, eating popcorn, and watching a movie starring Gene Hackman as a tough cop with a foot fetish. I missed Wendy, probably at that moment listening to the Pippin Company sing Spread a Little Sunshine. But there are advantages to the two-guy scenario, such as being able to belch and fart without trying to cover it up. The next day, my last at home, we went for a walk along the disused railroad tracks that passed through the woods behind the house where I grew up. Mom's hard and fast rule had been that my friends and I had to stay away from those tracks. The last GS and WM freight had passed along them 10 years before, and weeds were growing up between the rusty ties, but that made no difference to Mom. She was convinced that if we played there, one last train, call it the kid-eating special, would go bulleting through and turn us all to paste. Only she was the one who got hit by an unscheduled train. Metastatic breast cancer at the age of 47. One mean fucking express. I'll miss having you around this summer, my dad said. I'll miss you too. Oh, before I forget, he reached into his breast pocket and brought out a check. Be sure to open an account and deposit it first thing. Ask them to speed the clearance if they can. I looked at the amount, not the 500 I'd asked for, but 1,000. Dad, can you afford this? Yes, mostly because you held on to your commons job and that saved me having to try to make up the difference. Think of it as a bonus. I kissed his cheek, which was scratchy. He hadn't shaved that morning. Thanks. Kid, you're more welcome than you know. He took a handkerchief from his pocket and wiped his eyes matter-of-factly without embarrassment. Sorry about the waterworks. It's hard when your kids go away. Someday you'll find that out for yourself, but hopefully you'll have a good woman to keep you company after they're gone. I thought of Mrs. Shoplaw saying kids are such a risk. Dad, are you going to be okay? He put the handkerchief back in his pocket and gave me a grin, sunny and unforced. Call me once in a while, and I will be. Also, don't let them put you to work climbing all over one of their damn roller coasters. That actually sounded sort of exciting, but I told him I wouldn't. But I never heard what he meant to say next, advice or admonition. He pointed. Will you look at that? 50 yards ahead of us, a doe had come out of the woods. She stepped delicately over one rusty GS and WM track and onto the rail bed, where the weeds and the goldenrod were so high they brushed against her sides. She paused there, looking at us calmly, ears cocked forward. What I remember about that moment was the silence. No birds sang. No plane went droning overhead. If my mother had been with us, she'd have had her camera and would have been taking pictures like mad. Thinking of that made me miss her in a way I hadn't in years. I gave my father a quick, fierce hug. I love you, Dad. I know, he said. I know. When I looked back, the deer was gone. A day later, so was I. When I got back to the big gray house at the end of Main Street in Heavens Bay, the sign made of shells had been taken down and put in storage because Mrs. Shoplaw had a full house for the summer. I blessed Lane Hardy for telling me to nail down a place to live. Joyland's summer troops had arrived and every rooming house in town was full. I shared the second floor with Tina Ackerley, the librarian. Mrs. Shoplaw had rented the accommodations on the third floor to a willowy red-headed art major named Aaron Cook and a stocky undergrad from Rutgers named Tom Kennedy. Aaron, who had taken photography courses both in high school and at Bard, had been hired as a Hollywood girl. As for Tom and me, happy helpers, he said. General employment, in other words. That's what the guy Fred Dean checked on my application. You? The same, I said. I think it means we're janitors. I doubt it. Really? Why? Because we're white, he said. And although we did our share of cleanup chores, he turned out to be largely correct. The custodial crew, 20 men and over 30 women who dressed in coveralls with Howie the Happy Hound patches sewn on the breast pockets, were all Haitians and Dominicans, and almost surely undocumented. They lived in their own little village 10 miles inland and were shuttled back and forth in a pair of retired school buses. Tom and I were making $4 an hour, Aaron a little more. God knows what the cleaners were making. They were exploited, of course, and saying that there were undocumented workers all over the South who had it far worse doesn't excuse it, nor does pointing out that it was 40 years ago. Although there was this, they never had to put on the fur. Neither did Aaron. Tom and I did. On the night before our first day at work, the three of us were sitting in the parlor of Maison Shoplaw, getting to know each other and speculating on the summer ahead. As we talked, the moon rose over the Atlantic, as calmly beautiful as the doe my father and I had seen standing on the old railroad tracks. It's an amusement park, for God's sake, Aaron said. How tough can it be? Easy for you to say, Tom told her. No one's going to expect you to hose down the Whirly Cups after every brat in Cub Scout Pack 18 loses his lunch halfway through the ride. I'll pitch in where I have to, she said. If it includes mopping up vomit as well as snapping pictures, so be it. I need this job. I've got grad school staring me in the face next year, and I'm exactly two steps from broke. We all ought to try to get on the same team, Tom said. And as it turned out, we did. All the work teams at Joyland had doggy names, and ours was Team Beagle. Just then, Emelina Shoplaw entered the parlor carrying a tray with 5 champagne flutes on it. Miss Ackerley, a beanpole with huge bespectacled eyes that gave her a Joyce Carol Oatesian look, walked beside her, bottle in hand. Tom Kennedy brightened. Do I spy French ginger ale? That looks just a little too elegant to be supermarket plunk. Champagne it is, Mrs. Shoplaw said. Although if you're expecting Moet and Chandon, young Mr. Kennedy, you're in for a disappointment. This isn't cold duck, but it's not the high price spread either. I can't speak for my new co-workers, Tom said, but as someone who educated his palate on apples apple, I don't think I'll be disappointed. Mrs. Shoplaw smiled. I always mark the beginning of summer this way, for good luck. Seems to work. I haven't lost a seasonal hire yet. Each of you take a glass, please. We did as we were told. Tina, will you pour? When the flutes were full, Mrs. Shoplaw raised hers and we raised ours. Here's to Aaron, Tom, and Devin, she said. May they have a wonderful summer and wear the fur only when the temperature's below 80 degrees. We clinked glasses and drank. Maybe not the high price spread, but pretty damned good. And with enough left for us all to have another swallow. This time it was Tom who offered the toast. Here's to Mrs. Shoplaw, who gives us shelter from the storm. Why, thank you, Tom. That's lovely. It won't get you a discount on the rent, though. We drank. I set my glass down, feeling just the tiniest bit buzzy. What is this about wearing the fur? I asked. Mrs. Shoplaw and Miss Ackerley looked at each other and smiled. It was a librarian who answered, although it wasn't really an answer at all. You'll find out, she said. Don't stay up late, children, Mrs. Shoplaw advised. You've got an early call. Your career in show business awaits. The call was early, 7 a.m., 2 hours before the park opened its doors in another summer. The three of us walked down the beach together. Tom talked most of the way. He always talked. It would have been wearisome if he hadn't been so amusing and relentlessly cheerful. I could see from the way Erin, walking in the surf with her sneakers dangling from the fingers of her left hand, looked at him that she was charmed and fascinated. I envied Tom his ability to do that. He was heavyset, and at least three doors down from handsome, but he was energetic and possessed the gift of gab I sadly lacked. Remember the old joke about the starlet who was so clueless she fucked the writer? "Man, how much do you think the people who own these places are worth?" he asked, waving an arm at the houses on Beach Row. We were just passing the big green one that looked like a castle. There was no sign of the woman and the boy in the wheelchair that day. Annie and Mike Ross came later. "Millions, probably," Erin said. "It ain't the Hamptons, but as my dad would say, it ain't cheeseburgers." "The amusement park probably brings the property values down a little," I said. I was looking at Joyland's three most distinctive landmarks silhouetted against the blue morning sky. Thunderball, Delirium Shaker, Carolina Spin. "Nah, you don't understand the rich guy mindset," Tom said. "It's like when they pass bums looking for handouts on the street. They just erase them from their field of vision." "Bums? What bums?" "And that park? Same deal." "What park?" "People who own these houses live, like, on another plane of existence." He stopped, shading his eyes and looking at the green Victorian that was going to play such a large part in my life that fall, after Erin Cook and Tom Kennedy, by then a couple, had gone back to school. "That one's going to be mine. I'll be expecting to take possession on June 1st, 1987. "I'll bring the champagne," Erin said, and we all laughed. I saw Joyland's entire crew of summer hires in one place for the first and last time that morning. We gathered in Surf Auditorium, the concert hall where all those B-list country acts and aging rockers performed. There were almost 200 of us. Most, like Tom, Erin, and me, were college students willing to work for peanuts. Some of the full-timers were there as well. I saw Rosie Gold, today dressed for work in her gypsy duds and dangly earrings. Lane Hardy was up on stage, placing a mic at the podium and then checking it with a series of thudding finger taps. His derby was present and accounted for, cocked at its usual just-so angle. I don't know how he picked me out of all those milling kids, but he did, and sketched me a little salute off the tilted brim of his lid. I sent him one right back. He finished his work, nodded, jumped off the stage, and took the seat Rosie had been saving for him. Fred Dean walked briskly out from the wings. "Be seated, please, all of you be seated. Before you get your team assignments, the owner of Joyland and your employer would like to say a few words. Please give a hand to Mr. Bradley Easterbrook." We did as we were told, and an old man emerged from the wings, walking with the careful, high-stepping strides of someone with bad hips or a bad back or both. He was tall and amazingly thin, dressed in a black suit that made him look more like an undertaker than a man who owned an amusement park. His face was long, pale, covered with bumps and moles. Shaving must have been torture for him, but he had a clean one. Ebony hair that had surely come out of a bottle and was swept back from his deeply lined brow. He stood beside the podium, his enormous hands, they seemed to be nothing but knuckles, clasped before him. His eyes were deep set in pouched sockets. Age looked at youth, and youth's applause first weakened, then died. I'm not sure what we expected. Possibly a mournful foghorn voice telling us that Red Death would soon hold sway over all. Then he smiled, and it lit him up like a jukebox. You could almost hear a sigh of relief rustle through the summer hires. I found out later that this was the summer Bradley Easterbrook turned 93. "You guys," he said, "welcome to Joyland." And then before stepping behind the podium, he actually bowed to us. He took several seconds adjusting the mic, which produced a series of amplified screeks and skronks. He never took his sunken eyes from us as he did it. "I see many returning faces. Thing that always makes me happy. For you greenies, I hope this will be the best summer of your life. The yardstick by which you will judge all your future employment. That is no doubt an extravagant wish, but anyone who runs a place like this year in and year out must have a wide streak of extravagance. For certain, you'll never have another job like it." He surveyed us, giving the poor Mike's articulated neck another twist as he did so. In a few moments, Mr. Dean and Mrs. Brenda Rafferty, who is queen of the front office, will give you team assignments. There will be 7 of you to a team, and you will be expected to act as a team and work as a team. Your team's tasks will be assigned by your team leader and will vary from week to week, sometimes from day to day. If variety is a spice of life, you will find the next 3 months very spicy indeed. I hope you will keep one thought foremost in your mind, young ladies and gentlemen. Will you do that? He paused as if expecting us to answer, but nobody made a sound. We only looked at him, a very old man in a black suit and a white shirt open at the collar. When he spoke again, it might have been himself he was talking to, at least to begin with. This is a badly broken world, full of wars and cruelty and senseless tragedy. Every human being who inhabits it has served his or her portion of unhappiness and wakeful nights. Those of you who don't already know that will come to know it. Given such sad but undeniable facts of the human condition, you have been given the priceless gift this summer. You are here to sell fun. In exchange for the hard-earned dollars of your customers, you will parcel out happiness. Children will go home and dream of what they saw here and what they did here. I hope you will remember that. When the work is hard, as it sometimes will be, or when people are rude, as they often will be, or when you feel your best efforts have gone unappreciated. This is a different world, one that has its own customs and its own language, which we simply call the talk. You'll begin learning it today as you learn to talk the talk. You'll learn to walk the walk. I'm not going to explain that because it can't be explained. It can only be learned. Tom leaned close to me and whispered, "Talk the talk, walk the walk. Did we just wander into an AA meeting?" I hushed him. I had come in expecting to get a list of commandments, mostly thou shalt nots. Instead, I had gotten a kind of rough poetry. I was delighted. Bradley Easterbrook surveyed us, then suddenly displayed those horsey teeth in another grin. This one looked big enough to eat the world. Aaron Cook was staring at him raptly. So were most of the new summer hires. It was the way students stare at a teacher who offers a new and possibly wonderful way of looking at reality. "I hope you'll enjoy your work here. But when you don't, when, for instance, it's your turn to wear the fur, try to remember how privileged you are. In a sad and dark world, we are a little island of happiness. Many of you already have plans for your lives. You hope to become doctors, lawyers, I don't know, politicians." "Oh, God, no!" someone shouted to general laughter. I would have said Easterbrook's grin could not possibly have widened, but it did. Tom was shaking his head, but he had also given in. "Okay, now I get it," he whispered in my ear. "This guy is the Jesus of fun." "You'll have interesting, fruitful lives, my young friends. You'll do many good things and have many remarkable experiences. But I hope you'll always look back on your time in Joyland as something special. We don't sell furniture. We don't sell cars. We don't sell land or houses or retirement funds. We have no political agenda. We sell fun. Never forget that. Thank you for your attention. Now go forth." He stepped away from the podium, gave another bow, and left the stage in that same painful high-stepping stride. He was gone almost before the applause began. It was one of the best speeches I ever heard, because it was truth rather than horseshit. I mean, listen, how many rubes can put sold fun for 3 months in 1973 on their resume? All the team leaders were longtime Joyland employees who worked the Kearney circuit as showies in the off-season. Most were also on the Park Services Committee, which meant they had to deal with the state and federal regulations, both very loose in 1973, and field customer complaints. That summer, most of the complaints were about the new no-smoking policy. Our team leader was a peppy little guy named Gary Allen, a 70-something who ran the Annie Oakley Shooting Gallery, only none of us called it that after the first day. In the talk, a shooting gallery was a bang-shy, and Gary was the bang-shy agent. The 7 of us on Team Beagle met him at his joint, where he was setting out rifles on chains. My first official Joyland job, along with Aaron, Tom, and the other 4 guys on the team, was putting the prizes on the shelves. The ones that got pride of place were the big fuzzy stuffed animals that hardly anyone ever won. Although, Gary said, he was careful to give out at least one every evening when the tip was hot. "I like the marks," he said. "Yes, I do. And the marks I like the best are the points, by which I mean the pretty girls. And the points I like the best are the ones who wear the low-cut tops and bend forward to shoot like this. He snatched up the .22 modified to shoot BBs. It also had been modified to make a loud and satisfying bang with each trigger pull, and leaned forward to demonstrate. When a guy does that, I notify him that they're fouling the line. The points? Never. Ronnie Houston, a bespectacled, anxious-looking young man wearing a Florida State University cap, said, "I don't see any foul line, Mr. Allen." Gary looked at him, hands fisted on his non-existent hips. His jeans seemed to be staying up in defiance of gravity. "Listen up, son. I got three things for you. Ready?" Ronnie nodded. He looked like he wanted to take notes. He also looked like he wanted to hide behind the rest of us. "First thing, you can call me Gary or Pops or come here, you old son of a bitch, but I ain't no school teacher, so can a mister. Second thing, I never want to see that fucking schoolboy hat on your head again. Third thing, the foul line is wherever I say the foul line is on any given night. I can do that because it's in my mind." He tapped one sunken, vein-gnarled temple to make his point perfectly clear, then waved at the prizes, the targets, and the counter where the conies, the rubes, laid down their mooch. "This is all in my mind. The shy's mental. Get it?" Ronnie didn't, but he nodded vigorously. "Now whip off that turdish-looking schoolboy hat. Get you a Joyland visor or a Howie the Happy Hound dog top. Make it job one." Ronnie whipped off his FSU lib with alacrity and stuck it in his back pocket. Later that day, I believe within the hour, he replaced it with a Howie cap, known in the talk as a dog top. After 3 days of ribbing and being called greeny, he took his new dog top out to the parking lot, found a nice greasy spot, and trampled it for a while. When he put it back on, it had the right look. Or almost. Ronnie Houston never got the complete right look. Some people were just destined to be greenies forever. I remember Tom sidling up to him one day and suggesting that he needed to piss on it a little to give it that final touch that means so much. When he saw Ronnie was on the verge of taking him seriously, Tom backpedaled and said just soaking it in the Atlantic would achieve the same effect. Meanwhile, Pops was surveying us. "Speaking of good-looking ladies, I perceive we have one among us." Aaron smiled modestly. "Hollywood girl, darling?" "That's what Mr. Dean said I'd be doing, yes." "Then you want to go see Brenda Rafferty. She's second in command around here, and she's also the park girl mom. She'll get you fitted up with one of those cute green dresses. Tell her you want yours extra short."
"The hell I will, you old lecher," Aaron said, and promptly joined him when he threw back his head and bellowed laughter.
"Pert? Sassy? Do I like it? I do. When you're not snapping pics of the conies, you come on back to your pops and I'll find you something to do. But change out of that dress first. You don't want to get grease or sawdust on it. Capiche?"
"Yes," Aaron said. She was all business again. Pops Allen looked at his watch.
"Park opens in 1 hour, kiddies, and then you'll learn while you earn. Start with the rides."
He pointed to us one by one, naming rides. I got the Carolina Spin, which pleased me.
"Got time for a question or two, but no more than that. Anybody got one, or are you good to go?"
I raised my hand. He nodded at me and asked my name. "Devin Jones, sir."
"You call me sir again and you're fired, lad."
"Devin Jones, Pops." I certainly wasn't going to call him, "Come here, you old son of a bitch," at least not yet. Maybe when we knew each other better.
"There you go," he said, nodding. "What's on your mind, Jonesy, besides that fine head of red hair?"
"What's Carney from Carney mean?"
"Means you're like old man Easterbrook. His father worked the Carney circuit back in the Dust Bowl days, and his grandfather worked it back when they had a fake Indian show featuring Big Chief Yell at ya."
"You got to be kidding," Tom exclaimed almost exultantly. Pops gave him a cool stare that settled Tom down, a thing not always easy to do.
"Son, do you know what history is?"
Stuff that happened in the past?"
"Nope,"
he said, tying on his canvas change belt.
"History is a collective and ancestral shit of the human race, a great big and ever-growing pile of crap. Right now we're standing at the top of it, but pretty soon we'll be buried under the doo-doo of generations yet to come. That's why your folks' clothes look so funny in old photographs, to name but a single example. And as someone who's destined to be buried beneath the shit of your children and grandchildren, I think you should be just a little more forgiving."
Tom opened his mouth, probably to make a smart comeback, then wisely closed it again. George Preston, another member of Team Beagle, spoke up. "Are you Carney from Carney?"
"Nope. My daddy was a cattle rancher in Oregon. Now my brothers run the spread.
I'm the black sheep of the family and damn proud of it. Okay, if there's nothing else, it's time to quit this foolishness and get down to business.
Can I ask one more thing? Aaron asked.
Only because you're pretty.
What does wearing the fur mean?
Pops Allen smiled. He placed his hands on the mooch counter of his shy. Tell me, little lady, do you have an idea what it might mean?
Well, yes.
The smile widened into a grin that showed every yellowing fang in our new team leader's mouth. Then you're probably right.
What did I do at Joyland that summer?
Everything. Sold tickets, pushed a popcorn wagon, sold funnel cakes, cotton candy, and a zillion hot dogs, which we called hound dogs, you probably knew that. It was a hound dog that got my picture in the paper, as a matter of fact, although I wasn't the guy who sold the unlucky pup. George Preston did. I worked as a lifeguard, both on the beach and at Happy Lake, the indoor pool where the splash and crash water slide ended. I line danced with the other members of Team Beagle to Bird Dance Beat. Does your chewing gum lose its flavor on the bedpost overnight? Rippy Rappy, Zippy Zappy, and a dozen other nonsense songs in the Wiggle Waggle Village, where I also did time, most of it happy, as an unlicensed childminder. In the Wiggle Waggle, the approved rallying cry when faced with a bawling kitty was, "Let's turn that frown upside down." And I not only liked it, I got good at it. It was in the Wiggle Waggle that I decided having kids at some point in the future was an actual good idea, rather than a windy-flavored daydream. I, and all the other happy helpers, learned to race from one side of Joyland to the other in nothing flat, using either the alleys behind the shies, joints, rides, and concessions, or one of the three service tunnels known as Joyland Under, Hound Dog Under, and the Boulevard. I hauled trash by the ton, usually driving it in an electric cart down the boulevard, a shadowy and sinister thoroughfare lit by ancient fluorescent bar lights that stuttered and buzzed. I even worked a few times as a roadie, hauling amps and monitors when one of the acts showed up late and unsupported. I learned to talk the talk. Some of it, like Bally for Free Show or Gone Larry for a Ride that had broken down, was pure carny and as old as the hills. Other terms, like points for purty girls and thumps for the chronic complainers, were strictly Joyland lingo. I suppose other parks have their own version of the talk, but underneath it's always carny from carny. A hammer squash is a coney, usually a fump, who bitches about having to wait in line. The last hour of the day, at Joyland, that was 10 p.m. to 11, was the blow-off. A coney who loses at some shy and wants his mooch back is a mooch hammer. The Doniker is the bathroom, as in, "Hey Jonesy, hustle down to the Doniker by the moon rocket. Some dumb fump just puked in one of the sinks." Running the concessions, known as joints, came easy to most of us, and really, anyone who can make change is qualified to push the popcorn wagon or work the counter of a souvenir shop. Learning to ride jock wasn't much more difficult, but it was scary at first, because there were lives in your hands, many those of little children.
"Here for your lesson?" Lane Hardy asked me when I joined him at the Carolina Spin.
"Good, just in time. Park opens in 20 minutes. We do it the way they do it in the Navy. See one, do one, teach one. Right now, that heavyset kid you were standing next to?
Tom Kennedy?
Okay, right now Tom's over learning the devil wagons. At some point, probably this very day, he's going to teach you how to run the ride. You'll teach him how to run the spin, which, by the way, is an Aussie wheel, meaning it runs counterclockwise."
"Is that important?"
"Nope," he said, "but I think it's interesting. There are only a few in the States. It has two speeds, slow and really slow,
because it's a grandma ride."
"Correctamundo." He demonstrated with the long stick shift I had seen him operating on the day I got my job, then made me take over the stick with the bicycle hand grip at the top. "Feel it click when it's in gear?"
"Yes."
"Here's stop." He put his hand over mine and pulled the lever all the way up. This time the click was harder, and the enormous wheel stopped at once, the cars rocking gently. "With me so far?"
"I guess so. Listen, don't I need a permit or a license or something to run this thing?"
"You got a license, don't you?"
"Sure, a main driver's license, but..."
"In South Carolina, valid DL's all you need. They'll get around to additional regulations in time. They always do. But for this year, at least, you're good to go. Now pay attention, because this is the most important part. Do you see that yellow stripe on the side of the housing?"
I did. It was just to the right of the ramp leading up to the ride.
"Each car has a Happy Hound decal on the door. When you see the hound lining up with the yellow stripe, you pull stop, and there'll be a car right where the folks get on."
He yanked the lever forward again.
See?
I said I did.
Until the wheels tips.
What?
Loaded. Tips means loaded.
Don't ask me why. Until the wheels tips, you just alternate between super slow and stop.
Once you've got a full load, which you'll have most of the time if we have a good season, you go to the normal slow speed. They get 4 minutes.
He pointed to a suitcase radio.
It's my boomy. But the rule is, when you run the ride, you control the tunes. Just no real blasting rock and roll, Who, Zep, Stone, stuff like that, until after the sun goes down. Got it?
Yeah. What about letting them off?
Exactly the same. Super slow, stop. Super slow, stop. Always line up the yellow stripe with the happy hound. You'll always have a car right at the ramp. You should be able to get 10 spins an hour. If the wheel's loaded each time, that's over 700 customers, which comes to almost a D note.
Which is what in English?
500.
I looked at him uncertainly.
I won't really have to do this, will I? I mean, it's your ride. It's Brad Easterbrook's ride, kiddo. They all are. I'm just another employee. Although I've been here a few years, I run the hoister most of the time, but not all the time. And hey, stop sweating. There are carnies where half-drunk bikers covered with tattoos do this. If they can, you can.
If you say so.
Lane pointed. Gates are open and here come the conies rolling down Joyland Avenue. You're going to stick with me for the first three rides. Later on, you teach the rest of your team, and that includes your Hollywood girl. Okay?
It wasn't even close to okay. I was supposed to send people 170 feet in the air after a five-minute tutorial? It was insane.
He gripped my shoulder. You can do this, Jonesy. So never mind if you say so. Tell me it's okay.
It's okay, I said.
Good boy.
He turned on his radio, now hooked to a speaker high on the spins frame. The Hollies began to sing Long Cool Woman in a Black Dress as Lane took a pair of rawhide gloves from the back pocket of his jeans.
And get you a pair of these. You're going to need them. Also, you better start learning how to pitch.
He bent down, grabbed a handheld mic from the ever-present orange crate, put one foot up, and began to work the crowd.
Hey, folks, welcome in. Time to take a little spin. Hurry, hurry. Summer won't last forever. Take a ride upstairs where the air is rare. This is where the fun begins. Step over here and ride the spin.
He lowered the mic and gave me a wink.
That's my pitch, more or less. Give me a drink or three and it gets a lot better. You work out your own.
The first time I ran the spin by myself, my hands were shaking with terror. But by the end of the first week, I was running it like a pro, although Lane said my pitch needed a lot of work. I was also capable of running the Whirly Cups and the Devil Wagons, although ride jockeying the latter came down to little more than pushing the green start button and the red stop button, and getting the cars untangled when the rubes got them stuck together against the rubber bumpers, which was at least four times during each four-minute ride. Only when you were running the Devil Wagons, you didn't call them rides. Each run was a spree. I learned the talk. I learned the geography both above and below ground. I learned how to run a joint, take over a shy, and award plushies to good-looking points. It took a week or so to get most of it down, and it was 2 weeks before I started getting comfortable. Wearing the fur, however, I understood by 12:30 on my first day, and it was just my luck, good or bad, that Bradley Easterbrook happened to be in the Wiggle Waggle Village at the time, sitting on a bench and eating his usual lunch of bean sprouts and tofu. Hardly amusement park chow, but let's keep in mind that the man's food processing system hadn't been new since the days of bathtub gin and flappers. After my first impromptu performance as Howie the Happy Hound, I wore the fur a lot. Because I was good at it, you see. And Mr. Easterbrook knew I was good at it. I was wearing it a month or so later when I met the little girl in the red hat on Joyland Avenue. That first day was a madhouse, all right. I ran the Carolina spin with Lane until 10 o'clock, then alone for the next 90 minutes while he rushed around the park putting out opening day fires. By then, I no longer believed the wheel was going to malfunction and start running out of control like the merry-go-round in the old Alfred Hitchcock movie. The most terrifying thing was how trusting people were. Not a single dad with kids in tow detoured to my pitch to ask if I knew what I was doing. I didn't get as many spins as I should have. I was concentrating so hard on that damn yellow stripe that I gave myself a headache, but every spin I did get was tipsed. Erin came by once, pretty as a picture in her green Hollywood girl dress, and took pictures of some of the family groups waiting to get on. She took one of me, too. I still have it somewhere. When the wheel was turning again, she gripped me by the arm, little beads of sweat standing out on her forehead, her lips parted in a smile, her eyes shining.
"Is this great or what?"
she asked. "As long as I don't kill anybody, yeah," I said.
"If some little kid falls out of a car, just make sure you catch him."
Then, having given me something new to obsess about, she jogged off in search of new photo subjects. There was no shortage of people willing to pose for a gorgeous redhead on a summer morning, and she was right, actually. It was pretty great. Around 11:30, Lane came back. By that point, I was comfortable enough ride-jacking the spin to turn the rudimentary controls over to him with some reluctance.
"Who's your team leader, Jonesy? Gary Allen?"
"That's right."
"Well, go on over to his bang shy and see what he's got for you. If you're lucky, he'll send you down to the boneyard for lunch."
"What's the boneyard?"
"Where the help goes when they've got time off. Most carnies, it's the parking lot or out behind the trucks, but Joyland's luxe. There's a nice break room where the Boulevard and Hound Dog Under connect. Take the stairs between the balloon pitch and the knife show. You'll like it, but you only eat if Pop says it's okay. I ain't getting in Dutch with that old bastard. His team is his team. I got my own. You got a dinner bucket?"
"Didn't know I was supposed to bring one."
He grinned. "You'll learn. For today, stop at Ernie's Joints, the fried chicken place with the big plastic rooster on top. Show him your Joyland ID card and he'll give you the company discount."
I did end up eating fried chicken at Ernie's, but not until 2 that afternoon. Pop had other plans for me.
"Go by the costume shop. It's a trade between park services and the carpentry shop. Tell Dottie Lassen I sent you. Damn woman's busting her girdle."
"Want me to help you reload first?" The shooting gallery was also tips, the counter crowded with high school kids anxious to win those elusive plushies. More rubes, so I was already thinking of them, were lined up 3 deep behind the current shooters. Pop Allen's hands never stopped moving as he talked to me.
"What I want is for you to get on your pony and ride. I was doing this shit long before you were born. Which one are you anyway, Jonesy or Kennedy? I know you're not a dingbat in the college boy hat, but beyond that, I can't remember."
"I'm Jonesy."
"Well, Jonesy, you're going to spend an edifying hour in the Wiggle Waggle. It'll be edifying for the kiddies, anyhow. For you, maybe not so much."
He bared his yellow fangs in his trademark Pop Allen grin, the one that made him look like an elderly shark.
"Enjoy that fursuit."
The costume shop was also a madhouse, filled with women running every which way. Dottie Lassen, a skinny lady who needed a girdle like I needed elevator shoes, fell on me the second I walked through the door. She hooked her long-nailed fingers into my armpit and dragged me past clown costumes, cowboy costumes, a huge Uncle Sam suit with stilts leaning beside it against the wall, a couple of princess outfits, a rack of Hollywood girl dresses, and a rack of old-fashioned gay 90s bathing suits, which I found out we were condemned to wear when on lifeguard duty. At the very back of her crowded little empire were a dozen deflated dogs. Howie's, in fact, complete with the Happy Hound's delighted, stupid, and loving it grin, his big blue eyes, and his fuzzy cocked ears. Zippers ran down the backs of the suits from the neck to the base of the tail.
"Christ, you're a big one," Dottie said. "Thank God I got the extra large mended last week. The last kid who wore it ripped it out under both arms. There was a hole under the tail, too. He must have been eating Mexican food."
She snatched the XL Howie off the rack and slammed it into my arms. The tail curled around my leg like a python.
"You're going to the Wiggle Waggle, and I mean chop fucking chop. Butch Hadley was supposed to take care of that from Team Corgi, or so I thought, but he says his whole team's out with a key to the Midway."
I had no idea what that meant, and Dottie gave me no time to ask. She rolled her eyes in a way that indicated either good humor or the onset of madness and continued,
"You say what's the big deal? I'll tell you what's the big deal, Greenie. Mr. Easterbrook usually eats his lunch there. He always eats it there on the first day we're running full out, and if there's no Howie, he'll be very disappointed."
"Like as in someone will get fired?"
"No, as in very disappointed. Stick around a while and you'll know that's plenty bad enough. No one wants to disappoint him because he's a great man, which is nice, I suppose, but what's more important is he's a good guy. In this business, good guys are scarcer than hen's teeth."
She looked at me and made a sound like a small animal with its paw caught in a trap.
"Dear Christ, you're a big one, and green as grass, but it can't be helped."
I had a billion questions, but my tongue was frozen. All I could do was stare at the deflated Howie, who stared back at me. Do you know what I felt like just then? James Bond in the movie where he's tied to some kind of crazy exercise gadget.
"Do you expect me to talk?"
he asks Goldfinger, and Goldfinger replies with chilling good humor, "No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die." I was tied to a happiness machine instead of an exercise machine, but hey, same idea. No matter how hard I worked to keep up on that first day, the damn thing just kept going faster. "Take it down to the boneyard, kid. Please tell me you know where that is." "I do. Thank God Lane had told me." "Well, that's one for the home team anyway. When you get there, strip down to your undies. If you wear more than that while you're wearing the fur, you'll roast. And anybody ever tell you the first rule of Carney, kid?" I thought so, but it seemed safer to keep my mouth shut. "Always know where your wallet is. This park isn't anywhere near as sleazy as some of the places I worked in the flower of my youth, thank God, but that's still the first rule. Give it to me. I'll keep it for you." I handed over my wallet without protest. "Now go, but even before you strip down, drink a lot of water. I mean, until your belly feels swollen. Don't eat anything. I don't care how hungry you are. I've had kids get heat stroke and barf in Howie suits, and the results ain't pretty. Suit almost always has to be thrown out. Drink, strip, put on a fur, get someone to zip you up, then hustle down to the boulevard of the Wiggle Waggle. There's a sign. You can't miss it." I looked doubtfully at Howie's big blue eyes. "They're screen mesh," she said. "Don't worry, you'll see fine." "But what do I do?" She looked at me at first unsmiling, then her face, not just her mouth and eyes, but her whole face broke into a grin. The laugh that accompanied it was this weird honk that seemed to come through her nose. "You'll be fine," she said. People kept telling me that. "It's method acting, kiddo. Just find your inner dog." There were over a dozen new hires and a handful of old-timers having lunch in the boneyard when I arrived. Two of the greenies were Hollywood girls, but I had no time to be modest. After gulping a bellyful from the drinking fountain, I shucked down to my jockeys and sneakers. I shook out the Howie costume and stepped in, making sure to get my feet all the way down in the back paws. "Fur!" one of the old-timers yelled and slammed a fist down on the table. "Fur! Fur! Fur!" The others took it up, and the boneyard rang with the chant as I stood there in my underwear with a deflated Howie puddled around my shins. It was like being in the middle of a prison mess hall riot. Rarely have I felt so exquisitely stupid or so oddly heroic. It was showbiz, after all, and I was stepping into the breach. For a moment, it didn't matter that I didn't know what the fuck I was doing. "Fur! Fur! 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 Somebody zip me the hell up," I shouted. "I have to get down to the Wiggle Waggle post-haste." One of the girls did the honors, and I immediately saw why wearing the fur was such a big deal. The boneyard was air-conditioned. All of Joyland Under was, but I was already popping hard sweat. One of the old-timers came over and gave me a kindly pat on my Howie head. "I'll give you a ride, son," he said. "Cart's right there. Jump in." "Thanks." My voice was muffled. "Woof woof, Bowser!" someone called, and they all cracked up. We rolled down the boulevard with its spooky, stuttering fluorescent lights, a grizzled old guy in janitor greens with a giant blue-eyed German shepherd riding co-pilot. As he pulled up at the stairs marked with an arrow and the painted legend Wigwag on the center blocks, he said, "Don't talk. Howie never talks, just gives hugs and pats him on the head. Good luck, and if you start feeling all swimmy, get the hell out. Kids don't want to see Howie flop over with heat stroke." "I have no idea what I'm supposed to do," I said. "Nobody's told me." I don't know if that guy was Carney from Carney or not, but he knew something about Joyland. "It don't matter. The kids all love Howie. They'll know what to do." I clambered out of the cart, almost tripped over my tail, then grasped the string in my left front paw and gave it a yank to get the damn thing out of my way. I staggered up the stairs and fumbled with the lever of the door at the top. I could hear music, something vaguely remembered from my early childhood. I finally got the lever to go down. The door opened and bright June light flooded through Howie's screen mesh blue eyes, momentarily dazzling me. The music was louder now, being piped from overhead speakers, and I could put a name to it. The Hokey Pokey, that all-time nursery school hit. I saw swings, slides, and teeter-totters, an elaborate jungle gym, and a roundy-round being pushed by a greenie wearing long fuzzy rabbit ears and a powder-puff tail stuck to the seat of his jeans. The choo-choo wiggle, a toy train capable of dazzling speeds approaching 4 miles an hour, steamed by, loaded with little kids dutifully waving to their camera-toting parents. About a gazillion kids were boiling around, watched over by plenty of summer hires, plus a couple of full-time personnel who probably did have child care licenses. These two, a man and a woman, were wearing sweatshirts that read, "We love happy kids." Dead ahead was the long daycare building called Howie's Howdy House. I saw Mr. Easterbrook, too. He was sitting on a bench beneath a Joyland umbrella, dressed in his mortician suit and eating his lunch with chopsticks. He didn't see me at first. He was looking at a crocodile line of children being led toward the Howdy House by a couple of greenies. The kiddies could be parked there, I found this out later, for a maximum of 2 hours while the parents either took their older kids on the bigger rides or had lunch at Rock Lobster, the park's Class A restaurant. I also found out later that the eligibility ages for Howdy House ran from 3 to 6. Many of the children now approaching looked pretty mellow, probably because they were daycare vets from families where both parents worked. Others weren't taking it so well. Maybe they'd managed to keep a stiff upper lip at first, hearing Mommy and Daddy say they'd be back together in just an hour or two, as if a 4-year-old has any real concept of what an hour is. But now they were on their own, in a noisy and confusing place filled with strangers and Mommy and Daddy nowhere in sight. Some of those were crying, buried in the Howie costume, looking out through the screen mesh that served his eye holes and already sweating like a pig. I thought I was witnessing an act of uniquely American child abuse. Why would you bring your kid, your toddler for Christ's sake, to the jangling sprawl of an amusement park only to fob him or her off on a crew of strange babysitters even for a little while? The greenies in charge could see the tears spreading. Toddler angst is just another childhood disease, really, like measles. But their faces said they had no idea what to do about it. Why would they? It was day one, and they had been thrown into the mix with as little preparation as I had when Lane Hardy walked away and left me in charge of a gigantic Ferris wheel. But at least kids under 8 can't get on the spin without an adult, I thought. These little buggers are pretty much on their own. I didn't know what to do either, but felt I had to try something. I walked toward the line of kids with my front paws up and wagging my tail like mad. I couldn't see it, but I could feel it. And just as the first 2 or 3 saw me and pointed me out, inspiration struck. It was the music. I stopped at the intersection of Jellybean Road and Candy Cane Avenue, which happened to be directly beneath 2 of the blaring speakers. Standing almost 7 feet from paws to furry cocked ears, I'm sure I was quite a presence. I bowed to the kids who were now all staring with open mouths and wide eyes. As they watched, I began to do the hokey pokey. Sorrow and terror over lost parents were forgotten, at least for the time being. They laughed, some with tears still gleaming on their cheeks. They didn't quite dare approach, not while I was doing my clumsy little dance, but they crowded forward. There was wonder, but no fear. They all knew Howie. Those from the Carolinas had seen his afternoon TV show, and even those from far-flung, exotic locales like St. Louis and Omaha had seen brochures and advertisements on the Saturday morning cartoons. They understood that although Howie was a big dog, he was a good dog. He'd never bite. He was their friend. I put my left foot in, I put my left foot out. I put my left foot in and I shook it all about. I did the hokey pokey and I turned myself around because, as almost every little kid in America knows, that's what it's all about. I forgot about being hot and uncomfortable. I didn't think about how my undershorts were sticking in the crack of my ass. Later, I would have a bitch of a heat headache, but just then, I felt okay. Really good, in fact. And you know what? Wendy Keegan never once crossed my mind. When the music changed to the Sesame Street theme, I quit dancing, dropped to one padded knee, and held up my arms like Al Jolson. "Howie!" a little girl screamed, and all these years later I can still hear the perfect note of rapture in her voice. She ran forward, pink skirt swirling around her chubby knees. That did it. The orderly crocodile line dissolved. "The kids will know what to do," the old-timer had said, and how right he was. First they swarmed me, then they knocked me over, then they gathered around me hugging and laughing. The little girl in the pink skirt kissed my snout repeatedly, shouting, "Howie! Howie! Howie!" as she did it. Some of the parents who had ventured into the wiggle waggle to snap pictures were approaching, equally fascinated. I paddled my paws to get some space, rolled over, and got up before they could crush me with their love. Although just then I was loving them right back. For such a hot day, it was pretty cool. I didn't notice Mr. Easterbrook, reach into the jacket of his mortician's suit, bring out a walkie-talkie, and speak into it briefly. All I knew was that the Sesame Street music suddenly cut out and the hokey pokey started up again. I put my right paw in and my right paw out. The kids got into it right away, their eyes never leaving me, not wanting to miss the next move and be left behind. Pretty soon, we were all doing the hokey pokey at the intersection of Jelly Bean and Candy Cane. The Greeny Minders joined in. I'll be goddamned if some of the parents didn't join in as well. I even put my long tail in and pulled my long tail out. Laughing madly, the kids turned around and did the same, only with invisible tails. As the song wound down, I made an extravagant, "Come on, kids!" gesture with my left paw, inadvertently yanking my tail up so stringently I almost tore the troublesome fucker off, and led them toward the Howdy House. They followed as willingly as the children of Hamelin followed the Pied Piper, and not one of them was crying. That actually wasn't the best day of my brilliant, if I do say so myself, and I do, career as Howie the Happy Hound, but it was right up there. When they were safely inside Howdy House, the little girl in the pink skirt stood in the door long enough to wave me a bye-bye. I turned around and the world seemed to keep right on turning when I stopped. Sweat sheeted into my eyes, doubling Wiggle Waggle Village and everything in it. I wavered on my back paws. The entire performance from my first hokey pokey moves to the little girl waving bye-bye had only taken 7 minutes, 9 tops, but I was totally fried. I started trudging back the way I'd come, not sure what to do next.
"Son," a voice said, "over here."
It was Mr. Easterbrook. He was holding open a door in the back of the Wishing Well snack bar. It might have been the door I'd come through, probably was, but then I'd been too anxious and excited to notice. He ushered me inside, closed the door behind us, and pulled down the zipper at the back of the costume. Howie's surprisingly heavy head fell off of my own, and my damp skin drank up the blessed air conditioning. My skin, still winter white, it wouldn't stay that way for long, rashed out in goosebumps. I took big, deep breaths.
"Sit down on the steps," he said. "I'll call for a ride in a minute, but right now you need to get your wind back. The first few turns as Howie are always difficult, and the performance you just gave was particularly strenuous. It was also extraordinary."
"Thanks." It was all I could manage. Until I was back inside the cool quiet, I hadn't realized how close to my limit I was. "Thanks very much."
"Head down if you feel faint."
"Not faint. Got a headache, though." I snaked one arm out of Howie and wiped my face, which was dripping. "You kind of rescued me."
"Maximum time wearing Howie on a hot day, I'm talking July and August when the humidity is high and the temperature goes into the 90s, is 15 minutes,
Mr. Easterbrook said.
"If someone tries to tell you different, send them directly to me. And you'll be well advised to swallow a couple of salt pills. We want you summer kids to work hard, but we don't want to kill you."
He took out his walkie-talkie and spoke briefly and quietly. 5 minutes later, the old-timer showed up again in his cart with a couple anisin and a bottle of blessedly cold water. In the meantime, Mr. Easterbrook sat next to me, lowering himself to the top step leading down to the boulevard with a glassy care that made me a trifle nervous.
"What's your name, son?"
"Devin Jones, sir."
"Do they call you Jonesy?"
He didn't wait for me to reply.
"Of course they do. It's the carny way, and that's all Joyland is, really. A thinly disguised carny. Places like this won't last much longer. The Disneys and the Knott's Berry Farms are going to rule the amusement world, except maybe down here in Middle South. Tell me, aside from the heat, how did you enjoy your first turn wearing the fur?"
"I liked it."
"Because?"
"Because some of them were crying, I guess." He smiled.
"And?"
"Pretty soon all of them would have been crying, but I stopped it."
"Yes, you did the hokey pokey. Splinter of genius. How did you know it would work?"
"I didn't, but actually I did. On some level, I did." He smiled.
"At Joyland, we throw our new hires, our greenies into the mix without much in the way of preparation, because in some people, some gifted people, it encourages a sort of spontaneity that's very special and valuable, both to us and to our patrons. Did you learn something about yourself just now?"
"Geez, I don't know, maybe. But can I say something, sir?"
"Feel free."
I hesitated, then decided to take him at his word. Sending those kids to daycare. Daycare at an amusement park. It seems, I don't know, kind of mean. I added hastily, although the Wiggle Waggle seems really good for little people. Really fun. You have to understand something, son. At Joyland, we're in the black this much. He held a thumb and forefinger only a smidge apart. When parents know there's care for their wee ones, even for just a couple of hours, they bring the whole family. If they needed to hire a babysitter at home, they might not come at all, and our profit margin would disappear. I take your point, but I have a point too. Most of those little ones have never been to a place like this before. They'll remember it the way they remember their first movie or their first day at school. Because of you, they won't remember crying because they were abandoned by their parents for a little while. They'll remember doing the hokey pokey with Howie the Happy Hound, who appeared like magic.
I guess.
He reached out, not for me, but for Howie. He stroked the fur with his gnarled fingers as he spoke. The Disney parks are scripted, and I hate that. Hate it. I think what they're doing down there in Orlando is fun pimping. I'm a Seat of the Pants fan, and sometimes I see someone who's a Seat of the Pants genius. That could be you. Too early to tell for sure, but yes, it could be you.
He put his hands to the small of his back and stretched. I heard an alarmingly loud series of cracking noises.
Might I share your cart back to the boneyard? I think I've had enough sun for one day.
My cart is your cart. Since Joyland was his park, that was literally true.
I think you'll wear the fur a lot this summer. Most of the young people see that as a burden or even a punishment. I don't believe that you will. Am I wrong?
He wasn't. I've done a lot of jobs in the years since then, and my current editorial gig, probably my last gig before retirement seizes me in its claws, is terrific. But I never felt so weirdly happy, so absolutely in the right place as I did when I was 21, wearing the fur and doing the hokey pokey on a hot day in June. Seat of the Pants, baby.